You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 17th of April 2018 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Live from Midori House in London, this is the Monocle Daily. I'm Paul Osborne. Coming up, Donald Trump prepares to meet one of the few world leaders who is perhaps more embattled than he is, Japan's Shinzo Abe. We'll ask what both men are hoping to get from those talks. France's Emmanuel Macron issues a call to take on the anti-EU wave that's sweeping across much of Europe. Later, we'll ask how he plans to do that. Plus, Canada acts to protect diplomats' families amid a bizarre chain of illnesses at its embassy in Cuba. Also today,
I think for me, Milan is a very beautiful city. It has this intense, it's very dense, but it's very architectural. There's a solidity to Italian making. Italians are makers. You know, they have pride in making.
We'll visit one of the standout stalls at this year's Salone del Mobile Design Fair in Milan. Plus, recognition for hip-hop from one of America's most austere organizations.
And last, but certainly not least, for music. The prize is awarded to Damn by Kendrick Lamar.
We'll reflect on that Pulitzer Prize a little later in the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. Well, welcome to today's Monocle Daily. It is rare that a day goes by without the word embattled attaching itself to Donald Trump's White House. Sometimes it's rare to go an hour. But the US president is about to meet a world leader who perhaps has an even stronger claim to that label. Japan's Shinzo Abe goes into their talks with speculation mounting that he can't hang on much longer as the country's prime minister. So what's at stake for both men and what is likely to happen? Questions for my first guest in the studio this evening. Duncan Bartlett is the editor of Asian Affairs magazine, formerly BBC's Man in Tokyo. Duncan, Shinzo Abe is mired in corruption claims, an approval rating in free fall. Tens of thousands of people lined up to protest against him in Tokyo at the weekend. This is not a great backdrop for a visit to Donald Trump.
No, it's very much an ongoing political drama in Japan, and everybody is gripped by it. 50,000 people actually stood outside the Prime Minister's office on Friday and Saturday night chanting for him to resign, and not surprisingly, that received absolutely massive media coverage. Shinzo Abe's been in power as Prime Minister for about 5.5 years this time around. He's a very successful politician in many ways. He's won 3 national elections. He won one in the middle of last year, hands down. But the scandal, such as it is, relates to him and his wife. It's about the sale of a state asset at apparently a very highly discounted price, and then allegations of a cover-up by local government officials. I mean, it's not quite as dramatic as the scandal surrounding President Trump in terms of his relationship with the Russians and with porn actresses and all the rest. But it is nevertheless something which has gripped Japan and something which Mr. Abe is really fighting for political survival from.
Indeed, one of his predecessors has been predicting that he won't last much beyond the summer.
Indeed. Mr. Koizumi, who belonged to the same political party, gave an interview to a magazine in Japan, and he suggested that he thought that Mr. Abe might be out by June. Well, Mr. Abe was determined, though, to get this trip to America under his belt. And obviously what he's hoping for is that he will be seen in a good light by the international media and by the American media as a result of his talks with Donald Trump.
I mean, normally, anybody who is standing next to Donald Trump ends up looking pretty statesmanlike just by comparison. But as you say, at a time like this, he needs to take something away from this. What can he take away from it?
Well, Mr. Abe wants 2 things out of the meeting with Mr. Trump. He wants some leverage on the North Korean talks. As we know, Mr. Trump has said that he's going to meet Kim Jong-un later on this summer for direct face-to-face talks, and Mr. Abe wants to help set the agenda for that. And Mr. Abe is also looking for a better trade relationship with the United States, because Mr. Trump, rather shockingly, put some tariffs on imports of Japanese steel into the United States. That was a bit of a sideswipe at Japan, which was really aimed at China, but that's part of the trade war going on between America and China at the moment. Japan was a bit of collateral damage. So the main item on the agenda, and what Mr. Abe wants to raise first and foremost, is what is Mr. Trump going to say when he meets Kim Jong-un of North Korea?
And there's a certain sense, isn't there, that Japan has sort of slipped a little behind the curve on North Korea, because it was very much saying to the US, you can't trust North Korea, you can't engage with them. And then suddenly out of the blue comes this Donald Trump announcement that he's going to attend this summit meeting. South Korea starts to engage with it. Then suddenly Mr. Abe wants talks with Kim as well.
Well, it's not surprising, is it, that North Korea is the number one political and diplomatic issue in Japan, because it was less than a year ago that several times North Korean ballistic missiles flew over Japanese territory and crashed into the sea. Japan has regularly been threatened by North Korea with nuclear attacks. Everybody in Japan has a mobile phone in their pocket, and when North Korea launches a missile, it shakes and an alarm message comes up warning North Korean missile firing over Japan at this moment. It's a terrifying prospect. What Mr. Abe wants to avoid is Mr. Trump doing some sort of deal with Kim Jong-un, which means that the missiles no longer are able to reach America, but are still a very real threat to cities in Japan like Tokyo and Osaka.
And one of the problems with that, of course, is persuading Donald Trump to take an interest in another country's defences in a way that effectively he will probably look at that and say, what's in it for America?
Well, of course, America has a very strong vested interest in the defence of Japan. It has 50,000 US Marines stationed permanently in Japan, in Tokyo and on the island of Okinawa. They've been involved in training Japanese troops as well. So if there was a war to break out in East Asia, at the moment, the United States would be very much involved. And of course, one of the things that Mr. Abe will also want from Mr. Trump is an absolutely solid pledge that if there was a conflict between Japan, North Korea or China, then America would come down in support of its long-term ally.
You mentioned at the beginning, you know, Donald Trump, perpetually beleaguered. Shinzo Abe, pretty beleaguered. So what's the power dynamic going to be between these two men in these meetings?
Well, if they can, I think they'll have a round of golf, because this meeting has been scheduled at the Mar-a-Lago Resort in Florida, and Mr. Abe's already played golf with Mr. Trump there. And in fact, when Mr. Trump went to Japan last year, they played golf together in the Kumamoto Country Club. What Mr. Trump didn't notice, though, was that while he wasn't looking, Mr. Abe fell into a bunker and got covered in sand and had to be picked up by the prime ministerial detail. The other interesting fact about these rounds of golf that they've played together, Paul, is that the result is strictly classified information. We do
the result of a golf match.
We do not know who the winner is. The only people who know who win these games of golf are the American Secret Service and the prime ministerial self-defense detail of the Japanese government.
And given the long-standing claims that Donald Trump has, shall we say, a history of not being entirely within the spirit of fair play when he plays golf, it's probably not in Mr. Abe's interest to say, yeah, I won that game.
Well, what they will want to do is to be photographed together looking very friendly immediately after the game. Last time, Mr. Trump brought some special hats, baseball hats, which they both wore, saying Shinzo and Donald special relationship. So Mr. Trump gets something to gain from having good relationships with Asian leaders. Mr. Abe, of course, will be looking to try to get some international prestige out of this trip. But, of course, Mr. Trump is a very unpredictable fellow, even in his home territory of Mar-a-Lago. So Mr. Abe will need all his diplomatic skill to ensure that this summit is a success.
Well, Donald Trump does love a baseball cap, as we all know. We'll have to leave it there, Duncan. Thank you very much. Duncan Bartlett is the editor of Asian Affairs magazine. You're listening to Monocle 24. Now, from Britain to Poland, from Austria to Hungary, Euroscepticism is very much in fashion. But today, France's president set himself against that, warning of a civil war between liberal democracy and authoritarianism. Emmanuel Macron was speaking to the European Parliament in Strasbourg, saying that people had forgotten what first bound Europe's countries together. Well, for more on his speech, I'm joined in the studio now by Benedict Pavia, who's the UK correspondent for France 24. Benedict, Mr. Macron's view in this speech was that now, the generation that is now dominant in politics, his generation, not only have no personal memories of the Second World War, but also don't have that many surviving relatives who lived through it. And so that link to the fears that first prompted countries in Europe after the war to start collaborating has eroded. He seems to think that's got a lot to do with the rise of this anti-EU opinion.
Funny that, because so do I. Being half French, half British, having the benefit of both those countries, one that was invaded, France, one that was bombed like France but not invaded, the United Kingdom, I think he is right, and I think that's a problem. And I think that the EU, it's not like it happened overnight. You know, it's a bit like a population explosion when countries like Egypt suddenly discover that the majority of the population are under 25. The point about the European Union is the raison d'être, we say in French, and it's also an expression in English, the very reason for it to exist, to function, and for people to believe in it. What we've had is we've had, in a sense, somewhat of a divorce between the people who were the founders, I think, and who, for those very reasons, let's create alliances and, you know, share things in the name of peace, that we move forward as peoples. And the politicians have kind of gone in one direction, and they've forgotten to bring a lot of their people with them. And you get this, whether it's rise of populism, as we've seen in Hungary, in Italy, and of course with the election of Mr. Macron, it was thought, since he roundly beat Marine Le Pen, the leader of the Front National in France, to the great surprise, it would seem, of quite a lot of British media, who seemed to think that Marine Le Pen was on her way to the Élysée. No. And so here is this, he was 39, he's now 40 years old, president, who is the most pro-European presidential campaigner France has ever had, in that sense, or certainly in the recent past, and president. He's made, I think it's 4 or 5 speeches, including today's, since he's become president almost a year ago last May. And this is something that he fundamentally believes, and he believes that this is the way forward. And he's very worried. He talked today about sleepwalking into the future, and he invited, I think it's 751 MEPs, to go and talk to their constituents, to their citizens. Fact of the matter is, if you just look around you, Paul, do you know who your MEP is? Most people in Britain don't, and often they don't care.
One of the issues with this is perhaps that his words will be welcomed by people who are supporters of European cooperation, but thinking back to the campaign in Britain ahead of the EU referendum, I remember talking to voters in sort of Brexit-leaning areas, And going through that history and saying, but the European Union was born out of merging coal and steel production precisely so that countries couldn't produce weapons individually that would then be turned on each other. That was the foundation of this. That sounds like a good thing, doesn't it? And people would just say, well, that's a long time ago. That's never going to happen again.
It didn't feel relevant to them.
So the issue is, how do you engage? You know, Mr. Macron will be able to win over people who are already well disposed to the EU. But how do you engage that generation that just doesn't have any kind of memory of that time with that kind of concept?
Well, you're quite right. That's absolutely the nub of the problem. And that's where it also very much needs to happen. Well, he's done that straight after giving the speech, then also responding to very many comments and reactions and some criticisms, it has to be said, in the European Parliament in Strasbourg, and getting a standing ovation. That should also be said. And I should also underline it's the first time that the French president has gone before the European Parliament. And that, in what was a very high profile exercise. So what he did after that is he went to what is called, really loosely in English, I would say, town hall meeting. And he made some opening remarks, and then he answered any questions. There was a 7-year-old, I think, or no, maybe 10-year-old young Frenchman who said, when can I expect to get a European identity card? You know, but the point is that dialogue between whether it's leaders or MEPs, one of the things I found is quite different in France and in Ireland, certainly, and I haven't seen it very often in the United Kingdom. Well, I should say in England, but I gather it is true in Wales, is sometimes by either a building or a bridge. In France, in Ireland, I gather in Wales, you will have signs and it says, funded by the European Union. Now, that's something concrete. And I think the problem that you were very ably historically and then bringing up to today, underlining and focusing on, is exactly the problem. People, I think, very much who voted for Brexit, amongst other things, think that they're not richer thanks to the European Union, think that this is a bunch of very remote people that have nothing to do with them, think that they were not democratically elected, and think that they have absolutely no influence or beneficial influence on their lives, and certainly wouldn't recognise that EU funds help them in their everyday lives. Well, when you look at how Wales voted and you realise that pockets of Wales are amongst the poorest in the whole of the European Union, and that those EU funds will need to be replaced by British funds, I think there was some astonishment, of course, on the continent, and particularly in France, amongst other countries, at the fact that the UK voted how it did. But that's water under the bridge now.
He also suggested in this speech that France will be willing to spend more money to make up the gap that will be left by Britain leaving the EU.
Yes, he did.
Now, it'd be interesting to see how that goes down in Germany, because Angela Merkel's been very reluctant to the idea that the larger European countries should somehow start bailing out everybody else, even more so if Britain's not there.
Possibly not very well. I mean, we've seen how long it's taken between the election and then the formation of a government. We were already hearing stirrings shortly after Mr. Macron's speech. Interestingly, he's going there, he's meeting the German Chancellor in 2 days' time. That will be a very important meeting. And indeed, I should say that some MEPs criticised the strong Franco-German relationship and talked about, in a family, you must all be equal. So quite nervous and not happy about that. But of course, the Franco-German axis has always been seen as the motor. Now that Britain is leaving, that we'll have to see how that plays out. And of course, there is this big summit in June that really is going to really focus on those reforms. And then this is really almost a launch today, I think, for Mr. Macron, because there will be these town hall meetings will take place in, I think it's 26 of the currently 28 EU member states. And this will be all the lead up to the May 2019 EU elections, which will be very crucial also, across the EU, but certainly also will play a big part in France.
Benedict, thank you very much. Benedict Pavia with me in the studio this evening. You're listening to the Monocle Daily. Still to come, we'll talk design in Milan, food from London's Soho. And in just a moment, the curious illnesses plaguing Canadian diplomats in Cuba.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Well, we go to Cuba next and to the mysterious illness plaguing American and Canadian diplomats and their families. For more than a year, some have suffered dizziness, headaches, and nausea. Well, now Canada has said it's to pull diplomats' families out of Havana. And officials, though, still seem no clearer to understanding what's causing it. Well, let's get more from Yossi Meckelberg, Head of International Relations, Social Sciences and Law at Regent's University here in London. Yossi, when this first emerged a year or so ago now, people were talking about some kind of complicated sonic attack targeting waves at the American embassy and now at the Canadian embassy as well. Is that still the theory?
Not really. They quite retracted this, the theory of the sonic attacks. Something is eavesdropping equipment that could have caused it. But reality, though the Cubans, and I've been to Cuba 2.5 months ago, and no one wants really to talk about what's happening. They're ready to criticize quite a bit the way that the Trump administration generally deal with Cuba right now, and specifically on this issue. They said that they're ready for FBI investigators, detectives, just to come in, and that's what they did. But there is no evidence what is causing that. The reason that the Canadians are withdrawing now more of their diplomats is because there is some illnesses that develops affecting apparently the brain. And they don't know what's the source. They don't want to put their diplomats at arm's way. Strangely enough, the next Secretary of State, Pompeo, just in evidence to Senate, said the other day that he would like to see more American diplomats going back to Cuba. So we get a bit of mixed messages there.
Well, the timing is awful for Cuba at a time when it's trying to open itself out to the world, when it's trying to improve its diplomatic relations. Yeah. Here you have, and particularly with regard to America, but here you have diplomats from two very powerful North American countries falling ill in mysterious circumstances. So you can understand, A, the desire to be seen to be cooperating, but B, the conspiracy theories that very quickly emerge about it.
Yeah, of a third party. In Cuba, you need to differentiate between Canadian and Americans, because the Canadians are the good North Americans for many years. 1 million Canadians are visiting Cuba every year. It's a great source of income, tourism from Canada, and generally good relations with Canada. So the idea that Canadian diplomats are actually affected by this, it's a disaster. But no one knows what's the cause of it right now. I'm sure some people might have the knowledge what's the source. Is it a third party? Of course, you know, it's quite fashionable to blame the Russians these days for everything. Some probably they should own up, but others not necessarily so. And it remains. It's especially affecting because it's a day or two before Raul Castro is leaving position. So he probably would have loved to leave his presidency with better relations with the United States. But this is not only this episode, but it's also the Trump administration. They would like to reverse the progress made under Obama. So these two things, the Trump administration and this affair, which is very bizarre in diplomatic history, affects probably the way that Cuba would go forward in changing its economy, changing its society, which they admit it's necessary.
I was going to ask how since the Trump administration arrived, how has Cuba tried to manage that? The talk from the White House about wanting to roll back some of those changes.
It was very interesting in Havana back in January. Is the what you say about almost every other party in the world? You ask about Donald Trump, and it's exactly the same. The unpredictability of him. This is the main danger, because they are not so sure what he's going to do next. But for the Cuban, being 90 miles away from unpredictability is even more dangerous. Now, they would like to see gradually opening of the American economy to Cuba and vice versa. But also there lies the danger. If it's too quick, they might go back to where they were in the 1950s before the revolution. So it has to be gradual, it has to be very careful, it has to be managed, it has not to undermine the socialist system in a way that it would completely collapse. Bear in mind, despite the poverty, despite the need for development, Cuba has very good education system, has very good health system. It's per capita, it trains more doctors than any other country in the world. So they have what to build on. What they need is to see the embargo removed. But even without Trump, it's impossible to remove the embargo as long as the Republicans have a majority in Congress. So in a way, even what Obama tried to do is a bit stuck there. We found the ability to simple thing for Cuban Airlines to fly to the United States, because someone might decide to go to court and demand to keep them there until, you know, they pay what they owe them from 1959.
And so this is very much the last thing they need, is to have to deal with this mysterious these mysterious brain injuries.
Completely,
is the last thing they'd want.
No, it's complete distraction. What they need, inside Cuba, in the way that they need what they call updates, but the rest of us call reforms, and the relations with the United States that determine so much of what happens in Cuba itself.
Yossi, thank you very much for coming in this evening. Yossi Meckelberg from Regent's University here in London. You're listening to The Daily from Monocle 24. A
statistic now that'll make you feel a little bit old. We are edging towards the 50th anniversary of the invention of hip-hop. It dominates the music charts and streaming statistics around the world. But it's often seemed to be underrepresented in terms of its recognition at major awards ceremonies. But no longer, after Kendrick Lamar was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Music for his most recent album, Damn. Let's hear a little bit of it. This track is DNA. I got means, I got riches building in my DNA. I got dark, I got evil that rot inside my DNA. I got off, I got trouble, some heart inside my DNA. I just win again like Wimbledon I serve. Yeah, that's him again, the sound, the engine in is like a bird. You see fireworks and Corvette tires skirt the boulevard. I know how you work. The award was announced by Dana Kennedy, who is Pulitzer Prize Administrator and is a past winner, too, in the field of journalism, is on the line now. It's not just the first hip-hop album to win this prize. It's the first time this prize has gone to an album that wasn't either from the worlds of classical or jazz. So it's quite a change.
It very much is. We're very proud of this, in fact. And we think that it is a big moment, both for hip-hop and for the Pulitzer Prizes. I would say that our jury and judging system worked exactly the way that it should, in that the best music won. And this year it happened to be hip-hop, and we are so glad to be in an era where we have broken a barrier in terms of the music category.
Now, the citation describes this album as virtuosic collection, unified by vernacular authenticity, with affecting vignettes that capture the complexity of modern African-American life. For people who maybe haven't listened to it, what is awaiting them when they do?
So it's a very textured, bold piece of music. It has two things going for it. One is obviously the authenticity of the message in the music, but it really is incredibly bold in terms of the specifics of the actual music itself. It's an album that is a work of what we would call vernacular avant-garde. It's a dense and sophisticated collage of hybrid sounds and polyrhythms that is layered under and around pulsing kinetic text. So it's actually really just brilliant music. Yeah. And keep in mind that our jury is made up of conductors and music critics and the like, and so they are very, very used to really dissecting the mechanics and the specifics of the actual textured music components, and really felt that this was a brilliant work of art.
Now, you've had a lot of reports that have been very praising of this decision, but some others have said, was it necessarily the right thing to recognize with an award like this somebody who is already staggeringly successful, rather than giving exposure to a more obscure one? But presumably you knew when you announced Kendrick Lamar as the winner of this prize, you were going to get that kind of reaction as well.
Sure, sure. So, you know what? This was based on the best work. It really was. And I think that there will be years when you will see a continuation of more obscure artists winning, and hopefully years where you will see more things like this. Art forms change, and creative expression changes, and this is healthy both for the music industry and for the Pulitzer process. We want to evolve and grow in all of our categories and welcome new kinds of entrants. So to the extent that that's the goal, I think we accomplished it.
Now, one of the criticisms of music prizes all over the world, the major award ceremonies, is that for a very long time, they really did sort of pay lip service to hip-hop, ignoring the fact that it was this monumentally successful form of music. And certainly if you watch the Grammys, you would think that sort of country and rock were still the dominant form. So is there a sense in which you're hoping that by doing something that grabs so many headlines, you will propel others who also hand out awards to maybe just think again about what they do?
You know, if that's the result of this, we would welcome that, and that's terrific. It wasn't the goal. It's so interesting being in and watching the juries deliberate and then being in on the board meeting. They really do pay attention to every piece of art or work in front of them in terms of the merits of that individual piece of body of work. And so That really was the goal, to reward something that, in this case, the jury and then ultimately the board found to be just superior and amazing work in terms of the quality. But if it means that hip-hop is being shown under a brighter light, that's fantastic. I know that my 12-year-old son knew who Kendrick Lamar was. My mother did not, and now they both do. And so I think that this achievement spans generations. It's going to open up a lot more people to hip-hop that maybe wouldn't have listened to it before.
Now, just looking at some of the other awards that were announced, there's also an award for the reporting that kick-started the Me Too movement.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I think that was such a stellar piece of journalism. I really do believe, I was saying this to a group of students yesterday, I think that students in this country and perhaps around the world, journalism students, will be studying that story for years in terms of how to really uncover a story of that magnitude and get people to talk on the record, and then to watch, when you do that kind of solid reporting, layered reporting, the ripple effects and the benefits to society that a story like that can have.
And it's interesting, wasn't it, to see that at a time when you're being told that those mainstream newspapers like the New York Times or magazines like the New Yorker are struggling to compete with all these endless online rivals, that it was those sort of old established media brands that were breaking that story.
Yes, yes. You know, one of the things about the prizes this year is the diversity in terms of the different categories that won. So, as you mentioned, some of the bigger news organizations with robust budgets won, but we also had some newspapers from very small categories win. One paper, I think, had a staff of like 14 people, and they won a Pulitzer Prize. And that's as it should be. You shouldn't have to have the biggest budget to win a prize. And in this case, it was really spread evenly among the types of news organizations that were represented among the winners.
That's fascinating. Thank you very much for your time today. Dana Kennedy there on the Pulitzer Prize award winners. Let's take a look now at some of the other stories we've been following today. The coffee chain Starbucks has announced it's to close more than 8,000 branches in the US next month for racial bias training. It's after the firm had to apologize over the arrest of two black men who were waiting for a friend in a Starbucks in Philadelphia. Managers say they're learning what they did wrong and the steps they need to take to fix it. One person's been killed after a US passenger jet was ripped off in midair. The Southwest Airlines flight from New York to Dallas had to make an emergency landing in Philadelphia when a window, wings and the fuselage were all damaged. Eyewitnesses claim a woman was partially sucked out of a window after it was pierced by engine debris. And Matthew Mellon, a billionaire who made a fortune from digital currency, has died at the age of 54. He'd suffered with drug addiction, and his family say he died at a rehab center in Mexico. Mellon was an early backer of a digital currency known as Ripple. This is the Monocle Daily. Well, next we look ahead to the latest edition of The Entrepreneurs, which this week hears from company founders who have left successful jobs to try something new. What does it take to give up a safe monthly salary and set off on your own? Well, Monocle's Matt Alagaya met Jackie Fast, who in 2010 founded a media marketing business called Slingshot Sponsorship, but last year left to set up a vineyard and wine brand in her native Canada.
It was the right time to sell. I'd been doing it for 7 years. 7 years is a long time. The longest I ever had a job before that was 3 years, 2.5 years, and I went on cycles of that. You get bored, right? And Slingshot was always changing, and that was good, but it kind of stagnated, and not because the business was stagnated. I just kind of got to the top of my game in that situation. So we were working with people like the Rolling Stones, Sir Richard Branson and stuff, and, you know, there was nowhere farther for me to go. And I think I need a challenge to kind of get me up in the morning.
What was it that gave you the impetus to start this new project?
I just always want to do something different, but also more tangible. So sponsorship effectively is selling an idea. It's selling nothing. And I'm very good at selling nothing. So can you imagine if I actually had something to sell? So I think, you know, I was just getting excited to sell like a pen or a candle, just something you could actually touch and show people, because it's just something I've never done before. I've always just sold thin air. I started looking at the things that interest me and the things that I'm interested in. Funny enough, sport is not of interest, so it was weird for me to do sponsorship in the first place. But, you know, I like to eat, I like to drink, probably like most people, and certainly most of your listeners. And so I decided to look at going into wine.
And tell me a bit about this new wine project. I mean, what's the idea and how are you going to make that a reality?
So there's this place in BC, which is in Canada, in the West Coast, that is relatively unknown outside of people in BC and Alberta, that is absolutely beautiful. It's kind of like the north of Napa Valley. It's got some exceptional wines, but more than that, it's got water sports. It reminds me a lot of Necker Island as well. And nobody's heard of it. So, you know, I speak to loads and loads of people, well-traveled people, and everybody has been to Canada, but they usually kind of do Banff or Vancouver and Stanley Park, which is beautiful, but nobody's ever heard of this place called the Okanagan, which is wine country in that part of town. And so I'm buying a pretty large vineyard and we'll be producing wines that are very different to the local area. The palate there is a little bit sweeter than what we're probably used to here in England, and seeing how that goes. And part of that also takes into account the tourism. So we'll be doing kind of like a water sports concierge thing. Again, can't say too much, but that, you know, reminds me of the stuff that, well, we used to do on Necker Island. We'll be combining that with kind of a private members thing. My friend is the CEO of Mixmag, so we're doing some kind of like artist stuff down there and trying to bring in some cool vibes to something that is, I guess you'd probably traditionally of the 55 plus year old who kind of like currently reside there.
I'm kind of interested in where the idea came from. If you're not, you know, someone who knows a lot about wine, where did the idea come from to buy a vineyard and start doing this?
I think probably at the initial part, it's ego-driven. Make some money, let's buy something really expensive and extravagant. I'm still relatively young, so if I lose it all, I don't really care that much. But when I went down there and I started speaking to them, so I have kind of an insatiable appetite for other people's businesses, and I think that's what makes me good at sponsorship. But when I was speaking to all of these people looking to sell their vineyards, you know, and asking them questions about how they make their net profit, how they find their winemakers, all of this stuff, it just, there's a real opportunity for somebody to go in it in a different way. And I think I'm highly commercial and a budget is super, super important to me. Whereas you tend to have, I'd probably argue 95% of people that own vineyards is a family run business. You know, they just live off the land. They're not interested in making money. And then you've got those big, big commercial brands like Hardy's or Mission Hill that are so, so commercial. But there's nobody in the middle that is kind of boutique, wants to go global, looks at distribution and has a really good network. And I think that is kind of my sweet spot.
When you look at motivation, what motivated you to go into sponsorship, first of all? And how is your motivation different now?
I was so driven with Slingshot. So I worked in sponsorship for somebody else for a while and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the work, but it wasn't really enough. And actually owning my own business and the challenges that came with that were so much fun. You know, I do still love my job. I did love my job all the way to the end. And now I just need something harder, something bigger, a bigger project. I need more risk. So when I set up Slingshot, I just risked £2,000 on my laptop. Now I'm putting all my money on the table, which is, you know, my entire future, I guess, piggy bank of safety net, which I love. That's the best bit.
Is that not scary?
Yeah, of course. But it's, you know, if I did what I did with Slingshot with £2,000, I just, you know, what could I do with the money that I got from selling Slingshot?
Is it right in saying that you basically fell into sponsorship? It wasn't something that was a plan from the get-go?
I didn't even know what sponsorship was. I got the job, or I got offered a job to do sponsorship purely because I had the word sponsorship on a CV. I didn't really even do sponsorship in that job. That was just the title that they gave me. I 100% fell into it. 100% fell into it. And I set up Slingshot again because I couldn't get a job in a sponsorship agency. Nobody would hire me. And that's pretty well documented, which is relatively embarrassing. But, you know, it was a really tough market and I didn't understand it and didn't really understand what I was doing. But coming from all of those things and not knowing anything and kind of coming out of that and still being relatively successful in the exit of that business, I feel like I know a little bit about wine. Probably not enough, but a little bit.
And that's Jackie Farr speaking to Matt Alagaya, part of the new edition of The Entrepreneurs. You can hear it in full at 1900 London time tomorrow here on Monocle 24, anytime after that at monocle.com. Still to come on The Daily, we'll look through some of the top stories in Asia and we'll go on a culinary tour of Soho. Stay with us.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
Download Meet the Writers to join me, Georgina Godwin, as I talk to the award-winning Canadian-British blogger, journalist and science fiction author Cory Doctorow. He's the co-founder of one of the most influential blogs in the world. That's Cory Doctorow on Meet the Writers, available as a podcast now.
Now, Salone del Mobile is bringing the best in design to Milan this week. Monocle's Daphne Carnesis has been there looking for some of the more interesting stands. One of them belongs to Kvadrat, which is one of Europe's most important manufacturers of design textiles. She spoke a little earlier to Nipi Doshi and Jonathan Levien, who are the founders of the London-based design practice Doshi Levien, who have been collaborating with them.
We've designed two fabrics for Kvadrat called Ras and Lila. And we've also designed the stand for them, which is...
where we are now.
So the stand really is called Vertical Waves, and it really came from combining loops of fabric in the studio and seeing how the light fell on the fabrics and how it makes them shine and the colors really vibrant. And so we created an architectural scale of looped fabrics.
The specific fabrics that you're showing me now, are they new designs that you're showcasing here for the first time? Or?
Yes, so the collection that we've designed is called Ras and Lila, which was developed over the last year and is, of course, having its debut in Milan this year. Yeah, and that's actually the first upholstery fabric we've designed. We've designed curtains for Kvadrat before. For Kvadrat, it's our first upholstery collection.
How does it differ in terms of how you go about designing the fabrics, being sort of destined for furniture?
What's really important to, when you're designing textiles, especially for a company like Kvadrat, where people use meters and kilometers of their fabric, is that how do you get a sense of texture, pattern through texture and color, rather than pattern that's a kind of overt pattern. So for that, of course, you have to work very closely with the yarn construction. So in the case of Lila, for example, the fabric has almost like this boucle-like vintage Chanel kind of texture. It's a very luxurious fabric, and you imagine it more in the home. So when you're imagining a fabric for a home, for more comfortable seating, you can have a bolder texture. And when we were designing Ras, which is the other collection, it's more for contract and offices. So it's a sharper weave. So I think it's very subtle how the texture of the fabric really also completely determines the space that it's going to be used in. And I think in the case of Ras and Lila also, we did very intense color research in how the colors were combined together. So you see a lot of mid-tones and very unusual combinations, like you have a lavender with brown, you have like a deep maroon with a very light yellow, you have a very light blue and a very pale yellow together. So I think it's been mixing 150 colors in the studio by hand. And so we didn't really choose color, we created color in this collection.
The references were really diverse for this fabric. You know, we travel, we look around, and then somehow all those things that we're seeing and observing just percolate into our studio work. And Nipa went to Beijing recently and started her collection of Chinese ceramics, and brought back a beautiful selection of cups in these wonderful glazed colors. And Nipa's also been looking at 50s fashion, Balenciaga, Lanvin.
Indian miniature paintings from the Jodhpur Palace, and equally looking at Corbusier's paintings. So I think we're also finding our inspiration from very diverse cultures, diverse disciplines, and then, of course, really trying to create beauty, because Ras and Lila in Hindi means the dance or play of aesthetics.
And you're based in London and Columbia Road, is that right?
Yeah. That's correct, and the flower market.
Yeah. Lovely. What do you think of Milan as a city and kind of a hub for design compared to London, and also how it's evolved over the years?
I think for me, Milan is a very beautiful city. It has this intense, it's very dense, but it's very architectural. There's a solidity to Italian making. Italians are makers. You know, they have pride in making. And I think you really sense that in Milan, which is one of the industrial hubs of Italy, you know, this neighborhood. And I think I love that about Milan, that it's not very cosmopolitan, it's not international, but it has a very strong culture, you know. So it's very rooted in its culture. And I think that design for me is very linked to manufacturing. Having said that, I think that London for me is a real creative city. And a lot of designers who work in Italy are based in London, some of the best designers that I know. And I think that London gives you that freedom. It's international. You can really express yourself. And no one's rooted in London, really. You know, so I love that about London. I think London is definitely a creative, generally a creative capital, I say, because it's not just about furniture or product. You have architects, you have artists. You know, you have musicians and, you know, so I think it's more plural and diverse. But I think Italy is definitely rooted in making things beautifully.
And that's Nipa Doshi and Jonathan Levin, who are founders of the London-based design practice. Doshi Levin speaking to Monocle's Daphne Karnesis. And we'll have more from Slaneta Mobley through the week here on Monocle 24. Well, time now to look at some of the stories making headlines across Asia. Our focus today on India. My guest in the studio, Somnath Bhattabhiyal, who's a lecturer in media and development and international journalism at SOAS at the University of London. We're going to start with the economy. The growth forecasts for India looking reasonably good after the whole getting rid of all the money thing that happened a while ago.
Goods and services tax and demonetization, yes. There were two major incidents, as you mentioned, which had made the IMF and the World Bank pull down India's growth rate. But there were one-off factors, as they had mentioned. In all statistics, they say, tells you a partial truth, but that truth is important. It's absolutely true that it's India's growth rate, which is driving the South Asia as one of the most quickly advancing economies, regions in the entire world at the moment. And when you look at the West with growth rates of 0.5, 0.8, and squabbling about just point this and point that, India does seem to be in a very good position, along with China, which is also registering growth above 6%. And this transformation has happened in the last 20 years when India moved on from being a closed economy into one which embraced the global market very quickly. The transformation has affected about the lives of millions. Industries like the media has had massive changes. Infrastructure, especially roads, a bit of private education, private health. This has really kind of helped. And lifestyles, economies, it's been completely transformed. But the other story, of course, which dogs India is that still 400 million live below the poverty line. The trickle-down story of the economy hasn't really worked. Nobel Prize-winning economists like Amartya Sen has been constantly warning the government that, look, what we set out to achieve has not come through as yet. But also we must remember that India is a very young country, given that the independence happened only in 1947. So it's about a country which is about 70 years old. So I do not want to write off this massive growth spurt which has happened and the good that has brought that it has brought along with it. But the trick, or what trick is perhaps the wrong word to use, but the success of India as a country will now depend on whether we can change or at least affect this money, the 400 million who earn less than a dollar a day. Does the money go down to them? Does the benefits trickle down? That's the story.
The IMF can talk about how the economy is growing, but how much
influence does it have to be able to raise concerns about things like that? Say that the economy's doing fine, but as you say, it's actually not really having any impact on the great bulk of the population.
Well, IMF therefore is the problem. I mean, the IMF pushed through the structural adjustments reforms in 1993. And since then, the story goes two ways. One is this huge growth factor, the other side, which economists and the left argue is IMF driven, has reduced people to penury, millions into penury, and taken away government subsidies, government help, the reduction of the state, which is a story worldwide. So that story remains.
Now, a very disturbing story coming out of one part of India about sexual violence against women and children, but specifically caste and religious-based.
Yeah. This story, in a sense, the incident happens in January. It's only now that the Prime Minister of India and the senior ministers have decided that two state ministers of the BJP, which is the ruling party in India, let me just put this story in a quick bit of context. On the 10th of January, an 8-year-old girl in the Jammu and Kashmir, which is one of the troubled regions of India, though Hindu-dominated, was abducted. She belongs to a Muslim community. She belonged to a Muslim community, which were nomadic in nature. They were cattle herders. This girl was abducted, kept in a temple for a week, sedated and raped brutally by five men, three of them being government officials, one retired, two serving policemen. This is the main story. She dies after 7 days of brutality. But after that, the police were obstructed in filing a charge sheet by a Hindu nationalist mob. This mob was driven by these two ministers of the ruling party. It takes them nearly 3 months to finally even agree that they should resign from the government. I mean, this is the state of affairs which we're talking about. The mob which tried to prevent the officers from doing their duty included members of the court, women waving placards, and politicians from both sides, from the Congress and the BJP. I don't want to just say this. You know, this became one of the driving sentiments of a very pro-nationalist movement, which wanted to strike fear into the Muslim minorities, especially the nomadic tribes, which came into the small part of Jammu, which is Hindu-dominated.
We're a little short on time, but I just want to end by talking about this 19-year-old who impersonated a doctor.
Yes.
Successfully for quite a while.
For 5 months. I mean, this is the bizarre story. I mean, you know, on one hand, we have this great stories of economic growth. The other, the horrible stories of rape. And the third, this absolutely mind-boggling story that in India's premier medical institute, the All India Institute of Medical Sciences, a young man with no training manages to survive for 5 months, posing as a doctor, as a junior resident doctor, attends apparently all meetings, runs a marathon, shakes his hand with the opposition party leader Rahul Gandhi, the former minister of Bihar, chief minister of Bihar, Lalu Prasad Yadav, and carries it through. And only after 5 months did people kind of wake up to the event, call in the police and get him arrested. And he was doing this apparently, as he says, to get preferential treatment for his relatives.
I appreciate that it is a mark of getting old that you say that doctors and police officers and whatever all look so young.
Yeah.
But surely, when confronted with a doctor who basically is only just out of school, surely an alarm bell should be going off.
And again, this brings us to much more serious questions about security. Again, a very premier institute. We're not talking about a small private hospital somewhere in the corner of India. You're talking of heart of Delhi, where, as you would see in the photographs, the newspapers clippings I have sent you, the opposition leader Rahul Gandhi is shaking hands with him. So this does talk about a serious security breach. And what kind of infrastructure, again, is available in medical institutions, premier institutions across India?
Presumably, they're saying it won't happen again.
Again,
until the next time.
Again,
Dookie Howser walks into the room.
In a country of 1.4 billion people, stranger things have happened. You know, Shakespeare would be boggled here.
Stranger things have happened. Somnath, thank you very much indeed. Somnath Battabaya with some of the top stories from across India. You're listening to Monocle 24.
Well, finally, on tonight's Daily, it's time for Food Neighbourhoods. This is the spin-off podcast from our food and drink show, The Menu. Every week, it heads to an area with its own culinary story to tell. This week's heads to London's Soho, with Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco, a useful guide, as he is, in fact, a local resident.
We came from the far north, summered in Christ.
I might be biased, but for me, Soho is the best place for food and drink in London. Sure, Mayfair still delights with its fantastic Michelin-star restaurants, and in East, you can experience the new. But Soho is where it all comes together. I have been a resident of Soho for 5 years now, and it is rare that I have to rely on overpriced, bland takeaway options due to the abundance of restaurants in the bustling streets outside my home. Let me take you on a little journey, from my favorite breakfast to my usual haunt for a quiet nightcap. For breakfast, I like to keep it simple. The traditional English breakfast is not for me, so a cup of coffee or juice at Bar Italia would do. If you're in the mood, their hot chocolate is excellent. And along with Bar Bruno, the place has become a London institution. It makes me happy to see that not all breakfast establishments have morphed into those places where you can only order smashed avocado on sourdough. I bet they don't even use butter. A shame, in my opinion. But of course, the neighborhood has been changing abruptly in the last years, with many people saying Soho is losing its charm. Sure, this is something all residents should worry about, but for now, I think it is still a very attractive place for new cool restaurants. Sometimes I do wish that instead of another streetwear shop or glasses store, we could have a nice butcher, or how about a perfectly curated newsstand? Let's go. For lunch, there's so many options. My usual Saturday late lunch hangout is Polpetto from the Polpo restaurant family. It is my favorite. I love the dim lights and most importantly, the rigatoni with beef shin ragu. And being Brazilian, I'm extremely content with the addition of a South American restaurant in Berwick Street, Temper. Excellent food and the dessert of brigadeiro cookie is simply delicious. As of late, I have been obsessed with duck and rice. It's usually pretty crowded, but the food there gives me so much pleasure. Chinese comfort food at its very best. My recommendation is the crispy duck fried rice. For dessert, head to Old Compton Street for a scoop or two at Amorino. Best flavors are speculoos, or if you're lucky, they usually have seasonal specials to choose from. Last summer, I remember enjoying a delicious tangerine ice cream. And for dinner, you can always head to the traditional St. Moritz in Wardour Street, which I believe is the only Swiss restaurant in town. Remember, keep it simple and order the raclette or cheese fondue. With summer around the corner, maybe you're planning on brushing off those swim shorts, and with that in mind, maybe I should recommend something less heavy? Ding Street's Barrafina is the best of the best when it comes to Spanish food, and their fantastic selection of small plates won't leave you disappointed. And now, I think it's time for a drink. After all, you're in Soho. Bar Termini has excellent cocktails, as does Members Bar Disrepute. I know cocktails aren't for everyone, so for humble pint, my local is the Star and Garter on Poland Street. Soho is ever-changing, bars and restaurants come and go, and while that can sometimes be frustrating, it's what makes Soho exciting. I wouldn't have it any other way. For Monocle, I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Consider yourself fully updated on the culinary and drinking delights of Soho, which we are now free to explore, as that's it for today's Monocle Daily. It was produced by Tom Hall and Marcus Hippie. Our researchers are Paige Reynolds and Pierre-Antoine Denis. Our studio manager was Clara Barn. Georgina Godwin here in 8 hours' time at 7 a.m. in London for tomorrow's edition of The Globalist, and the Monocle Daily returns at 2200 London time tomorrow. For now, though, from me, Paul Osborne, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.